This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Billahir rahmanir rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك فك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
American and French presidents pledge a coordinated response to Russia, warning Moscow of severe economic costs in case of an invasion of Ukraine. China's president says the world is entering a new period of turbulence and transformation. Also in the headlines, CNN chief Jeff Zucker loses his career after his secret relationship with a top executive is exposed. Thank you for joining us. And our top story, the presidents of the United States and France pledged to coordinate their response to what they describe as Russia's military buildup on the Ukrainian border. During a phone call, Joe Biden and Emmanuel Macron agreed to work together closely, both in diplomacy and in preparations to punish Russia with severe economic costs if it invades its neighbor. They also reaffirmed their support for Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Macron has said before that he might visit Russia to seek a diplomatic solution to the crisis. The US and its allies accuse Moscow of planning to invade Ukraine, but Russia says it has no such intention and that it's moving troops on its own soil because it feels threatened by NATO's eastward expansion. We've talked to political analyst William Jones to get his thoughts on the recent escalation of tensions between Russia and the West over Ukraine. He believes that the US goal is to use the situation in Ukraine as a pretext to contain Russia.
There is no indication that Russia plans to invade Ukraine. The moves that they are taking on their border is on the border of a country which is in the state of a veritable civil war. And the reason they put the troops on the border is really to send a signal about not only about Ukraine, but also about the dangerous direction in which all of the agreements that had been made between Russia and the West since the fall of the Soviet Union are being violated effectively by the United States in this expansion of NATO right up to the border of Russia. Well, obviously, the United States, the West generally, the United States, is more interested in creating their own control over all of the parts of Europe that are not Russia. So that the goal here, although it's talked about in terms of the defense of Ukraine and victimization of Ukraine, is really an attempt to create a cordon around Russia, which they consider not only a rival and a competitor, but also a potential enemy. And by doing so, they hope that they can keep Russia in effectively so that no moves are made one way or the other, which would endanger the hegemony of the so-called U.S. rules of the road.
In other news, Russia vows to retaliate Germany's decision to shut down the German language service of Russian broadcaster RT. The Russian Foreign Ministry has slammed the media ban as unacceptable and politically motivated. It says Russia will take reciprocal measures against German media outlets and internet platforms that have deleted RTDE accounts. Germany says the Moscow-based TV channel lacks a valid German license. Russia denies that, saying RTDE has been operating under a European convention to which Germany is a party. Moscow says it will challenge the decision in court. Elsewhere, the Chinese president says the world today is facing multiple challenges, one being the COVID pandemic, and hence is going through a period of drastic change.
The world today, under the combined impact of changes unseen in 100 years and a once-in-a-century pandemic, is entering a new period of turbulence and transformation and facing multiple challenges to humanity.
Xi Jinping made the comments at a meeting of the International Olympic Committee via a brief video message ahead of the Beijing Olympics, which will officially kick off on Friday. He appreciated the efforts the committee has put into organizing the games in the face of the existing challenges. The Chinese president added that the World Olympics body has played a key role in bringing about global solidarity and cooperation to tide nations over in these difficult times. CNN is being rocked by a fresh scandal. The network's president, Jeff Zucker, has stepped down abruptly over a secret romance with another top executive. Zucker had admitted that he's been engaged in a consensual relationship with the chief marketing officer at CNN, but his failure to disclose the years-long relationship to the network has now cost him his career. Some CNN staff are pointing the finger at Chris Cuomo, a former primetime anchor. He was fired in December for assisting his brother, former New York governor Andrew Cuomo, in a case of sexual misconduct. Cuomo is now being blamed for exposing Zucker's romance to his attorneys when the channel started an internal investigation into his conduct. Zucker started working at CNN in 2013. Before that, he was the executive producer of NBC's Today Show and the president of NBC Entertainment. Racism seems to be an unending phenomenon in the United States. At least a dozen historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs, that were established decades ago for the African American community put their campuses on lockdown on Tuesday. The reason? They received bomb threats. That's a day after similar threats forced the cancellation of classes at other schools.
More than a dozen colleges and universities in many U.S. cities, from Baltimore to New Orleans, had to lock down or suspend classes as they received threats of bombing and mass shooting. That's on the first day of Black History Month, a time to honor, commemorate, and celebrate African American history and culture. Most of these institutions were founded in the years after the American Civil War, but Howard University was also among those threatened on Tuesday. The White House said it is taking the threat seriously, but added that it is still unclear what could have motivated those threats. However, the issue is not an isolated one, as the U.S. intelligence last year warned about racially motivated possible attacks by extremists, such as white supremacists.
HBCUs, like many other institutions in the black community, become targets when issues of race, issues of civil rights, issues of equality bubble to the surface and become the focal point of American society. Whenever African Americans begin to kind of push for rights, push for recognition, our institutions have then been targeted by those who seek to silence those voices.
The threats come as the United States remains a fertile ground for injustice, with the country being criticized for racial profiling, use of excessive force, and discrimination against minorities. The killing of George Floyd in 2020 is one of numerous examples of how African Americans are being treated in a country claimed to be the defender of human rights. Floyd is one among a dozen of recent black victims that gained global attention and sparked protests at home and abroad against U.S. police brutality. According to a U.S. media report, about 1 in 1,000 African Americans can expect to die at the hands of police in their lifetime, almost double that of their white counterparts.
In each generation, or every several years, there needs to be a major fight in order for black Americans to win equality and equity in the country. And now at a time when we're starting to see strides happening with more educated black Americans, black women are the most educated ethnic group in our country. When we're seeing these strides, we are also seeing a commensurate white lash that we have seen historically whenever black Americans increase their autonomy, increase their agency, and increase their socioeconomic mobility.
The racism is deep-rooted in the U.S. society, with discrimination being seen institutionalized in both political and economic domains. The attack on Capitol Hill last year was the culmination of the same, as rioters blatantly and proudly carried symbols of hate, meaning the attack had much to do with race in America. In the aftermath, threats against blacks and people of color became more evident. Repeated threats, shootings, and lack of transparency have already terrorized America's black community. It is feared that the country may be heading for more unrest and a dangerous divide if the country's leadership and politicians fail to act upon their long-cherished dream of equality.
Welcome back. Turning to other news now, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian warns his Emirati counterpart that the presence of Israel in the region poses a threat to all regional countries. In a phone call, Amir Abdollahian tells Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed that more efforts are needed to curb sources that would create crises in the region. Referring to the war on Yemen, Iran's top diplomat says the continuation of the conflict is not in the interest of either side involved. For his part, bin Zayed says Abu Dhabi strives to encourage all Yemeni parties to find a UN-backed political solution to the conflict. The phone call comes after a recent visit by the Israeli president to the UAE. Iran puts on trial the ringleader of a terrorist group. Evidence presented during the court session suggests that the group has received support from Saudi Arabia and Israel. Habib Chaib is accused of several bombings and terrorist operations in Iran's southwestern Khuzestan province. Chaib led the so-called Arab Struggle Movement for the Liberation of Ahwaz. During the session, it was revealed that members of the group visited Saudi Arabia annually. They received instructions from Saudi intelligence officers to carry out acts of terror inside Iran. One of the members also met with the Saudi king. Documents further show that Chaib himself had dealings with former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Political commentator Faraz Al-Najim says Saudi Arabia has a well-established record of sponsoring terrorist activities in the region.
We know the history of Saudi Arabia as a regime. Their state-sponsored and deviant extremist path, the Wahhabism, has always been exploiting terrorism and endorsing and supporting terrorism all through the world, especially in the Middle East. We've seen what they did in Iraq. So many suicide bombers blew themselves up in Iraq, killed a lot of innocent people. We've seen what they did in Syria. So it's nothing surprising when you hear about this happening in Iran, because that's their staunch enemy that they've created because of the U.S. Obviously, the U.S. and their allies are instructing the Saudi Arabian regime that Iran is your enemy. But Iran has never really committed any crime or any violation against the Saudi Arabian regime inside Saudi Arabia. We only see the fingerprints and the proof of the Saudi Arabian regime. We also seen this in 2010 when Abdul Malik Righi, another terrorist from the Balochistan area, also was for many years committing so many terrorist acts until they arrested him. Thank God that the Iranian government and their forces and their intelligence were so on top of this kind of case, and they have such strong intelligence that they were able to arrest this man. And he confessed at that point that Saudi Arabia had a big hand in this, the Americans had a big hand in this.
The diplomatic fallout between France and Mali has taken a turn for the worse, with the African state expelling the French ambassador. But why has Mali taken such a tough stance? Wasn't the French deployment meant to help fight against terrorists in Mali? Or perhaps, as many believe, the stated goal was nothing but a cover for other incentives, like the nation's rich mineral resources?
A diplomatic row is growing between Mali and France. The African nation has decided to expel the French ambassador over a series of outrageous and hostile comments by Paris about Mali's transitional government. An official statement by Malian authorities said the ambassador had been notified of the decision and given 72 hours to leave the country. The government of the Republic of Mali informs the national and international public that today the ambassador of France in Bamako, His Excellency Joel Mayer, was notified of the decision of the government, asking him to leave the national territory within 72 hours.
Well, right now there is a wave of anti-French sentiment building up and escalating throughout Mali, which has historical roots because France was the colonizer of Mali.
French Foreign Minister had earlier said that Mali's military government was out of control. He called the military government illegitimate. French Defense Minister also said on Saturday that French troops would not stay in Mali if the price was too high. The French Foreign Affairs Ministry said France was also recalling its ambassador from Mali. Rebel officers led a coup in August 2020 that toppled Mali's elected leader Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, who was facing angry protests at failures to stem armed violence.
Not that easy to actually build up the economy of Mali, especially in the north, where the terrorist violent extremists operate out of. And therefore, the people in Mali are more and more angry at what the French are doing and what the French are not doing. And this has been going on for many years, and now it's reaching a high point.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Imam Baqir, Repository of Celestial Knowledge. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, dear listeners, and heartiest congratulations to you on a very special occasion. Today is the first of Rajab, the month when God Almighty showers His blessings on the seekers of truth, the seekers of forgiveness, the penitents, the worshippers, and all those who strive in His path. This year, Rajab has started on Thursday, which means that tonight, the first Friday eve of this blessed month, is Laylatul Raghaib, or the Night of Desirability.
The word desirability here means the display of the innate desires of dedicated and pious Muslims for attaining the proximity of the Lord Most High. And this is possible only through acts of virtue. For this auspicious night, a special observance has been narrated from the Prophet. And among the virtues of this 12 rak'at prayer to be performed immediately after the Maghrib or evening prayer is expiation of many sins and unimaginable rewards. The first day of Rajab also happens to be the auspicious birth anniversary of a very special person. He was none other than the namesake of the Prophet of Islam, and in fact, the fifth infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Stay with us for a special feature on the life and times of Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, who was descended on both sides, that is, father and mother, from the Almighty's last and greatest messenger to all mankind. If I found worthy carriers for my knowledge, which Allah, the Great and Almighty, has given to me, I would proclaim monotheism, Islam, religion, and Islamic laws. How can I do that? My great-grandfather, the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, found no worthy carriers for his knowledge. Thus, he sighed deeply on the pulpit and said, "Question me before you lose me, for there is much knowledge among these ribs." What you heard is the statement recorded in Volume 2 of the book Safinatul Bihar from the namesake and 15th infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. He was prophesied by the Seal of Messengers as Baqirul Ulum, or the splitter and spreader of sciences. Born in the Prophet's city, Medina, 57 years after the Prophet's migration from Mecca to Medina, and 46 years after the passing away of the Prophet from the mortal world, Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, was knowledge personified. His father, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, was the son of the Prophet's younger grandson, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, while his mother, Fatima, peace upon her, was the daughter of the Prophet's elder grandson, Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him. He was inheritor of the celestial knowledge bequeathed by the Prophet on the commandment of God to his great grandfather, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him. It was divine providence he was born on the first of Rajab, which is one of the four sacred months of the Islamic calendar. It is the month in which the All-Merciful, in addition to the regular conduits of mercy, opens up special passageways to his creatures for attaining greater heights of virtue. Indeed, fortunate are those who grab this opportunity to strive towards the bounties of the hereafter. Last night, on the eve of Rajab, most of the faithful may have performed the special prayers and recited the exclusive supplications in the divine court. Today, many are fasting and are observing the special prayers of the first of Rajab, and will follow up tonight with exclusive prayers of Laylatul Raghaib, or the Night of Desirability. The faithful are humbly requesting God to firm up their faith, enlighten their minds, illuminate their hearts, purify their souls, strengthen their spirits, and make them worthy recipients of the bezels of knowledge specified by the 50 Imam. They are also praying to the Lord Most High to alleviate the sufferings of all believers, especially the defenseless people of Yemen, who are the victims of the criminal invasion and aerial bombardment of the past 7 years of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, which are backed by the US, Britain, and the illegal Zionist entity. God's promise is true. He will surely make the true believers triumphant, no matter what atrocities the hypocrites and the faithless commit, since He has preserved for the salvation of humanity the Prophet of Islam's 12th and last infallible heir, who will reappear in the end times as Imam Qa'im al-Mahdi. May God hasten his advent to rid planet Earth of all oppression through establishment of the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice. Amen. For his part, Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, who as a four-year-old was present in Karbala on the day of Ashura, or 10th of Muharram 61 AH, when history's most heartrending occurred, and who, in its equally tragic aftermath, despite his tender age, suffered imprisonment in Damascus, along with his parents, aunts and grand-aunts, Hazrat Zainab, peace upon her, and Umm Kulthum, peace upon her, has said, "The master of the affair was named as Mahdi because he will unearth the original Torah and other heavenly scripture from the cave in Antioch. He will judge among the people of the Torah according to the Torah, among the people of the Evangel according to the Evangel, among the people of Psalms in accordance with the Psalms, and among the people of the Qur'an in accordance with the Qur'an." These words from the Imam, on whose authority scholars wrote accounts of the prophets of the past, the Sunnah, Wasira, or behavior and practice of the Prophet of Islam, the exegesis of the ayahs of the Noble Qur'an, and the jurisprudential principles of the Sharia, provide solace to the hearts of not just Shia Muslims, but also our Sunni brethren, whose books of hadith are replete with countless narrations from Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him. As a matter of fact, all monotheists take comfort from the words of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, who, as the righteous heirs of the Prophet of Islam, preached peace, friendship, and fraternity, unlike the usurper Umayyad and Abbasid caliphs, who, like the satanic takfiri terrorists of our own days, divided Muslims into sects, massacred people, terrorized countries, destroyed the heritage of the nations of the past, and looted the masses to fill up their coffers. Those in doubt are invited to study the fruitful life of the fifth infallible Imam, who during his 19-year mission resisted against five tyrannical Umayyad caliphs whose empire that stretched from Spain in the west to Pakistan in the east has long evaporated. In order to pass on to posterity the ethereal values of universal brotherhood, Imam Baqir, peace upon him, groomed leading lights of Islam who could be called immortals. Names that come to mind are Zurar bin Ayan, the master theologian, Muhammad bin Muslim bin Raya, the eminent jurist, Fudail ibn Yasar, the exegete, Ma'ruf ibn Karub, the hadith compiler, Braid al-Jili, the rhetorician, and Abu Basir Layth al-Bakhtari, the famous traditionist. These six are mentioned in the list of the 10 pegs of the world. Then there was Abu Hamza Thamali, who held an esteemed place among the companions of both the fourth and fifth Imams, and through whose some moving supplications have been conveyed to posterity, including the famous one taught by Imam Zain al-Abidin, peace upon him, and recited till this day by the faithful before Sahar or late midnight in the fasting month of Ramadan. Among the fifth Imam's companions was also the renowned poet and master of Arabic literature, Kumayt ibn Zayd al-Asadi, whose panegyrics titled Al-Hashemiyat are still recited to this day. Imam Baqir, peace upon him, who, despite his grooming of scholars, would at times love to toil under the blazing sun of Arabia by personally engaging in farming in order to set the practical example of dignified labor for earning of legal and lawful subsistence bread, has said the following: "There is no job better than farming, and there is no benefit better than the benefit of farming, because both benevolent and malevolent grazing animals and birds benefit from it and pray for the farmer." He also encouraged people to marry, raise children, and cater to their needs in lawful and legal manner, but at the same time fulfill their duties towards Allah, the All-Merciful Creator. Here is one of the famous sayings of the fifth Imam on the authority of his ancestor, the Prophet: "Islam is a firm and decisive faith. Scale its heights, but calmly. Don't put excessive weight of prayer on your bodies. Don't be like a rider who tires his animal by traveling more than it possibly can. It may fail to carry you to your destination. Satan has misguided some of our people and made them abstain from meat and other delicacies. Such abstention is against the Sharia." In conclusion, in view of the significance of this month, we refer to a very famous hadith, which says that anyone who recites in Rajab, "Astaghfirullah wa atubu ilayh," 70 times in the morning and 70 times in the evening, and thereafter raising his hands, says, "Allahumma ighfir li wa atubu ilayh," should she or he die during Rajab? God shall be pleased with him or her, and hellfire shall not touch him or her.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a program that aims to address the most important issues in the South Asian region which affect the governments, organizations, and especially the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and provide you with some external perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will take a deep insight into the plight of Rohingya refugees in India. Does the country need a change in its existing law to adjust those fleeing persecution in their country of birth? And we will discuss why Hindu hardliners want to sideline Mahatma Gandhi, often insulting and questioning his status as the father of nation and his legacy of communal harmony.
Traitor, anti-Hindu and pro-Muslim are the words India in general and the world in particular have come across time and time again from the Hindu hardline right against none other than Mahatma Gandhi. Now, they have become vocal enough to use abusive language against him while describing Gandhi's assassin, Natoram Godse, as a patriot. Many right-wing Hindu leaders never mince words when it comes to criticizing Gandhi, but it's backfired this time, triggering outrage and leaving right-wing organizations with umbilical ties to the BJP government embarrassed.
Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi, addressed as Mahatma, meaning the revered one, is not only a freedom fighter, but a social and economic revolutionary. His idea of non-violence or passive political resistance against the then colonial rule is praised and followed all over the world. This multicultural, multi-ethnic country became a nation-state owing allegiance to one constitution, one flag, and one government only on August 15, 1947. But India achieving the milestone was never possible without popular movements and sacrifices made by freedom fighters. Gandhi, who actually started his anti-colonial mission in South Africa, became a force to reckon within the early 20th century. His decades-long movement, or Satyagraha, began against the plight of Indian planters and continued until Quit India, a movement in which he gave a call for the British to leave the country. so it seemed to a vast millions of Indians and who saw a father figure in him. But right-wing Hindu elements continue to question the Father of Nation, a title conferred upon Mahatma by the Constitution of Free India. As the new India is emerging, so the rhetoric and derogatory remarks by far-right ideologues, just like the one happened recently when a so-called Hindu monk used abusive remarks against Gandhi and glorified the one who assassinated him in 1948.
Police came into action against Hindu religious leader Kalicharan Maharaj after his video from a religious assembly held in the city of Raipur went viral on social media. He was arrested on the charge of promoting enmity between communities, making derogatory remarks against Gandhi and praising his assassin during his speech. The opposition is also demanding the arrest of other Hindu leaders for hate speeches. But will Prime Minister Modi succumb to the pressure ahead of the elections in five states?
It seems the biggest issue the right-wing groups commonly called Sangh Parivar has with Gandhi is that he advocated Hindu-Muslim unity. That's against their conception that Muslims and Christians are an internal threat to the nation. But there is another, probably more serious reason, for their hatred of Gandhi is his challenge to those hardliners who had gone on rampaging following the partition of the country in two, Pakistan and India. No wonder that Hindu hardliners and BJP leaders make public statements to build a narrative that blames Gandhi for the country's division and other ills. Still, even though it has been more than seven decades since Gandhi was assassinated, Hindutva forces feel compelled to question his authority. Sadly, the biggest Gandhi-hating segment lies within the Hindus and not outside it, as was seen in a recently held religious assembly. In fact, in today's India, everybody who chooses to abuse Gandhi should have complete freedom of expression since they have the backing of those ruling the country to pursue their Hindu agenda. The hate speeches of Hindu supremacists are actually an apology for not keeping the country intact, and Gandhi is always their convenient villain. But they are unable to accept the fact that no one is safe and nobody would have a future if they are allowed to go unchecked for making inflammatory speeches and creating a divisive environment.
Now to have more insight on the story, we are joined by Mr. Sanjeev Kumar, Senior Researcher on Gandhian Philosophy and Peace Studies. Mr. Kumar, welcome to the program, sir. Let's begin with your thoughts on Gandhi's role in establishing ideas of peaceful coexistence and equality in India.
When you try to understand a personality like Gandhi and his contributions, I think it's very difficult, you know, in the sense that if you try to understand his philosophy, often you see there are a lot of contrasting views on Gandhi. In the popular imagination, people have perceived Gandhi's life and journey in so many different ways. For some, he appears to be a Mahatma, great soul, a very ascetic person who inspired a very revolutionary movement in the country. Well, you see in the current discourse also, in the narratives of the discourse today, and of course, during the pre-colonial period, Gandhi was understood, you know, in a very ambivalent manner by people, you know, of course, with people whom he engaged on a day-to-day basis. If you look at the current works of people like Arundhati Roy, they have targeted Gandhi and has, in fact, went on to, brandish him as a kind of a reactionary, scholar who blustered the caste system. Even during his early stays, if you see in South Africa, he is argued that he held a very derogatory views toward the native communities. Now you see all this, ambivalent or I say critical position that people take on Gandhi are by a selective reading of Gandhi, not in terms of making a true assessment of Gandhi in terms of not only the contributions he has made for the country, largely in the subcontinent, but as a global scholar, you know, I think his ideas, you know, are extremely important when we look at the current, you know, crisis we are undergoing today.
Mr. Kumar, Gandhi's critics today have called him a traitor and praised his assassin, who had the same line of criticism. Now, could this be a way of intensifying extremism?
Yeah, I think so. It is true because, as I spoke in the discussions earlier, that Gandhi has an idea of accommodative truth, inclusive idea of India, that of course rested on on a very profound idea of religiosity that Gandhi brings in his worldview. When we try to understand at other spectrum the ideas of Hindutva, you have to understand it is based on exclusionary criteria, and that is why there are two different views, or you can say two different spectrums through which where we see India of today, is heading towards. One is Gandhi's idea of Hinduism, which brings the idea of inclusive accommodative truth, where there is another idea, pitted idea of Hindutva. Of course, it has gained credence today, not to say that it has not gained popularity, but you have to also see that those people who work in the name of Savarkar's Hindutva do try to refer and go back to Gandhi, because there is no alternative to Gandhi, you have to understand. That is why you see, Gandhi is often brought to the public imaginary, even if it is a ritualistic visit to Rajghat or celebrating or bringing certain activities, in the name of Gandhi.
There you have it, Mr. Sanjeev Kumar from New Delhi. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people reacted on social media on the issue.
A cabinet minister of the government of Maharashtra says an insult to Mahatma Gandhi is an insult to our nation. Strict actions should be taken against Kalicharan, and he should be booked for insulting the father of our nation. Indian Congress Party leader Rahul Gandhi reacts on his Twitter to an insult to the father of nation by writing Mahatma Gandhi's own words, quote, "You can chain me, torture me, you can destroy this body, but you cannot imprison my thoughts." An Indian activist posts a Gandhi's picture on his Twitter and says Gandhi, wrapped in his white shawl, sits before a microphone to speak at a prayer meeting in Delhi. It was the second day of his fast on January 14, 1948, for communal peace. He ended his fast on January 18th after being given a pledge of harmony by leaders of different communities.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh.
The lack of a domestic refugee protection framework has meant that India's recognition and protection of refugees has been inconsistent and subject to political will and motivation. In the absence of a legal mechanism, the country has seen deviating from its obligations to uphold human rights principle. The reason probably is the religion of Rohingyas. Since the controversial Citizenship Act passed by the Narendra Modi-led government in 2019 provided a pathway to citizenship for persecuted minorities from several neighboring countries, unless they are not Muslims.
Anti-Rohingya sentiment and discrimination seem rampant in India since their arrival to save their lives from a state-sponsored persecution in Myanmar. They not only face deplorable conditions, but are increasingly persecuted for the same reason they were in Myanmar, their religion. That's amid anti-Muslim sentiment in the country that has risen since the right-wing Bharatiya Janata Party under Prime Minister Narendra Modi came to power. Over the past few years, the Modi government has introduced controversial policy changes by revoking the semi-autonomous status of the only Muslim-majority state of Kashmir to passing a controversial citizenship law. In due process, Rohingya have become a target as well. Throughout its history, India has accepted refugees fleeing persecution elsewhere, including Tamils, Tibetans, and Afghans. So what has changed now? Of course, there is a change of government with right-wing Hindu groups at the helm. Ironically, Indian rulers cite stateless Rohingya a threat to security, denying them everything they need under international humanitarian laws. Rohingya refugees living in camps in different cities and regions, including Jammu, Hyderabad, Nuh and the capital New Delhi, many of them believed to be undocumented. Several times, they have witnessed their slums being burnt, with media and officials citing unknown reasons. But the reasons are lucid and clear, as they all go in the backdrop of the lack of a domestic refugee protection framework, and refugees, especially Rohingya, are subject to political will and motivation.
The 1951 Refugee Convention clearly states that the asylum state shall not return any refugee to a territory where his life or freedom is endangered due to his race, religion, nationality, or political alignment or opinion. However, India's treatment of Rohingyas has been conspicuously different. In an affidavit filed by the Indian government in the Supreme Court in 2017 on the deportation of Rohingyas, not only called them illegal and infiltrator, but also a threat to security. So the question is, are they really posing a threat to India?
Given that India is not a signatory to the Refugee Convention, it maintains that it has no obligation to provide asylum or be bound by the principle. However, as a signatory to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, it owes obligations to uphold human rights principles nonetheless. In the absence of a legal framework, persons from different countries are treated differently, as stipulated in the 2019 controversial legislation of the Modi government. It puts a question mark on a country that wants to get a permanent seat on the UN Security Council. Myanmar's leadership took no heed to the international calls to stop the carnage, with the West's own human rights champion Aung San Suu Kyi facing international ire for being a mute spectator. It was a shameful moment for Suu Kyi to face the International Court of Justice last year over a petition launched by the Gambia against Myanmar, accusing it of violating the 1948 Genocide Convention. Will Suu Kyi or any world leaders with sound minds support what happened to an ethnic community in Myanmar? Answer is mixed, seeing the track record of some countries. India falls into this category given its ill treatment of Rohingya. Even India's Supreme Court sided with a government petition to deport dozens of Rohingya under the pretext of a security threat.
Now, to have more insight on the topic, we are joined by Dr. Moang Zani from London, a human rights activist and co-founder of Free Rohingya Coalition. First of all, glad to have you with us, Dr. Zani. As you know, right-wing leaders refer to the Rohingya Muslims as infiltrators. Do you think this is an effort to identify them as a threat to India's national security?
No, this is not an attempt to identify Rohingyas as a threat to national security of India. This is an attempt to frame the Rohingya as a threat. That's different from Rohingyas being identified or being
they're really a threat to national security of India. India is 1 billion people country with one of the world's largest military and intelligence networks. So the Rohingyas who fled genocide in Burma and sought refuge in India, they're less than 20,000. You know, that may even be an overestimation. And but you know, mind you, India is particularly the ruling party BJP that wants to remake India as you know, essentially a country of non-Muslims, primarily Hindus and maybe some Buddhists. They have been using this kind of a threat to national security language over the last 5 years. And I was in New Delhi for a security conference, you know, organized by Facebook and one other think tank based in New Delhi. And I share a panel with a BJP member, and also I heard, you know, the high senior officials from the Indian Home Ministry that basically use what I consider and what many genocide scholars would recognize as the, you know, the language of genocidal killers, that is, you know, weak and vulnerable the national or ethnic or religious community, is falsely framed as a threat to national security, you know, a threat to the purity of their religion, their what they consider their race. And you know, this is the kind of thing that we heard in the Nazi Germany.
Dr. Zani, with India's record of harboring refugees escaping persecution, do you see any difference in how they treat Rohingya refugees and those of other ethnicities?
Yes, absolutely. You know, if you look at how welcoming India has been, you know, since the 1950s to